Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone. This is Ryan Tripp. I've returned to the New Book Network's History Channel. Today, we're going to be discussing the constitutional origins of the American Civil War, out earlier this year by Cambridge University Press. The author is Michael F. Conlin. He's professor of history at Eastern Washington University. Welcome to the show, Professor Conlin.
Thank you so very much for having me.
So before we dive into the questions. Can you discuss a little bit about your selection of the cover image for the book?
Yes, it's a kind of an iconic image by Currier and Ives of the Massachusetts 54th storming Fort Wagner. And so it pits African American soldiers fighting Southern secessionists in, you know, perhaps the most secessionist state, South Carolina.
Now, what prompted you to study the Fed?
And so it seemed like a apropos way to, you know, show the book's argument of linking the Constitution and the Civil War.
Thanks. Now, what prompted you to study the federal Constitution as, quote, more or less neutral, yet implemented in a pro-slavery fashion? And what do you mean by ordinary Americans and popular constitutionalism? And why did you organize the book thematically rather than chronologically?
Well, I study the Constitution as more or less neutral just because I think a lot of the leading scholarship suggests there are parts, of course, of the Constitution that supported slavery, and we'll cover those, I think, in some detail. The book, of course, does. but there are other parts that have great promise for anti-slavery. And the Constitution, it was far more pro-slavery and its implementation than the mere text. And Don Fehrenbacher's book makes this argument. So does Earl Maltz. And I think you'll see when we talk about the book, and the listeners will see hear this as well, that there was a lot of ways the Constitution could have been, the practice of the Constitution could have been far less pro-slavery than it actually was. And the book focuses on ordinary Americans and popular constitutionalism just to show that this wasn't a conceit of elites. I define ordinary Americans in a somewhat idiosyncratic way because this is concerning the Constitution. And so I don't define ordinary Americans versus elite Americans in terms of social class, but more but actually in regards to their familiarity with the Constitution. And I take this take my page from Michael Kamen, who first made this distinction in a brilliant book on popular constitutionalism and published about, I guess, two or three decades ago. But anyway, the idea is that most Americans, even Americans who went to university, even Americans who were lawyers, did not have extensive training and constitutional law. Today, you know, it's quite a common thing in political science and history courses for undergraduates to have training in the Constitution, and certainly in law school. But this was not so in the U.S. in the 1840s and 50s. In fact, there were just a very few law schools. Most Most American lawyers trained by reading law, like Abraham Lincoln and Stephen A. Douglas did. And so in that way, they had no real exposure to constitutional law. And I define elites as people who either taught constitutional law or who held a nation or statewide or national office as an effort to tease out, or people who actually went to law school, even though they often didn't have a course in constitutional law. And popular constitutionalism, quite simply, is looking at how we, the people, the American people, interpreted the Constitution, read the Constitution. And one of the arguments in my book is that antebellum Americans had a pretty sophisticated knowledge of some very recondite provisions of the Constitution. For example, the Guarantee Clause, clauses that bits of the Constitution that most Americans today are only vaguely aware of, or frankly aren't aware of at all, and really are only known to specialists. And I organized the book thematically just because I look at the interpretations of the Constitution by the American people, North and South, black and white, elite and non-elite, as more or less static during this period. And I try to follow various threads of elements of this popular constitutionalism. They don't so much evolve over time, but are kind of organized in these various themes, many of which actually relate to the Constitution itself, the structure of the Constitution, the practice of the Constitution, and the implementation of the Constitution.
How and why did most antebellum Americans celebrate the federal Constitution as, quote, civil gospel? And how did the memory of anti-slavery, pro-slavery, and or silent framers and their constitutional euphemisms shape antebellum sectional divisions, anti-slavery factionalism, and the arguments of Northern conservatives?
Well, antebellum Americans were really quite proud that theirs was the first written constitution. They took great pride in that. They loved to contrast their what they call the model republic, and it was a model constitutional republic with governments around the world, including and often it was an invidious comparison. Often they took it as unquestioned that the United States was the freest nation in the world, and they did so, of course, even though slavery was an incredibly important part of our political, economic, and social system. They frequently made contrast with the Ottoman Empire, the Russian Empire, various European empires, the Habsburgs, the Bourbons, and of course with even with England, or I should say the UK. They of course, which in some ways our system is has a direct line to. They noted that the Britain has an unwritten constitution, whereas we have a written one, and they noted that the Britain had the House of Lords, and of course still does. And Britain, even with its Great Reform Act of 1832, enfranchised a tiny fraction of the British male population vis-a-vis the United States during the period of so-called Jacksonian democracy. And for all these reasons, then Americans, almost all Americans, really the Garrisonian abolitionists were the only exception, lauded the Constitution as a charter of liberty, and they celebrated it in ways that I think we often reserve today for the Bill of Rights or the Declaration of Independence. There were public readings of the Constitution. There were technical books that gave extended analyses of every clause of the Constitution. And there were even some public celebrations where people paraded and lauded the Constitution. And as far as the founders, not only did the antebellum Americans follow know the Constitution and with quite an impressive sophistication, they also knew a lot about the lives and deeds and the actions of the various founders. You know, the 55 delegates to the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia in the summer of 1787, and they were they anxiously awaited efforts of various people to publish the notes or records of the convention. They were, especially for particularly controversial bits of the Constitution, say the Fugitive Slave Clause, for example, or the Three-Fifths Clause, they were quite well aware of the debates in Philadelphia over the merits or demerits of those clauses. And many of the, especially when it came to the matters of the sectional conflict over slavery, many of the people in the 1830s, 40s, and 50s took their cues from founders that they believed followed their beliefs, or that they, perhaps sometimes doing violence to the actual history, claimed followed their views. For example, almost everyone claimed James Madison. He was the father of the Constitution. He was the single most influential delegate. And even though he was a lifelong Virginia slaveholder, even all but the most radical abolitionist, the Garrisonians, claimed him as either a proto-abolitionist or a dedicated positive good advocate of slavery and everything in between.
How and why did the economic contours of early disputes over constitutional construction and individual rights focus on chattel slavery and then exacerbate sectional divisions? Also, why was the guarantee clause crucial in these antebellum debates, and how did this clause demonstrate the depths of popular knowledge of the federal Constitution?
Just as they quarreled over the proper interpretation or construction, if you like, of the Constitution and various clauses, or the various founders, they also quarreled over the various proper constructions. And a lot of those debates would be very familiar to our ears today. There were certainly, although they didn't necessarily call themselves this, originalists. There were textualists. There were advocates of a living Constitution. Those are the main schools. And they were very much present in the 1830s, 40s, and 50s. And of course, the debates over slavery quickly came to focus on individual rights, the right to property, due process. We find the fifth in the Due Process Clause and the Fifth Amendment, and of course, the right to individual liberty. Slavery was a social institution an arrangement, but also as an economic arrangement. And white Southern slaveholders very much considered slaves to be first and foremost property. Before the Civil War, most Americans believed the 10th Amendment expressly put the institution of slavery beyond the reach of the federal government. It was one of those so-called delegated powers that the states had not given to the federal government. That attitude would change once the war began, and eventually would culminate in Abraham Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation, and ultimately in the passage and ratification of the 13th Amendment in December 1865. Disparate views of how to interpret the Constitution, came to focus on slavery. Now, the disparate views on how to interpret the Constitution as regard to economic matters appeared quite early, as early as the debate over whether it was permissible to have Congress establish a national bank just a couple years after the Constitution was ratified during the first term of the Washington administration. And even at that early date, we see some of the framers, the founders, Alexander Hamilton saying it was permissible and James Madison famously saying it wasn't. We see these debates over the interpretation of the Constitution from the very people who wrote it, not even half a dozen years after it was ratified. My book just looks at the issues of slavery. It doesn't delve into these wider-ranging issues, the issues of slavery and the issues that lead us to the Civil War. But it absolutely shapes the sectional conflict. And quite famously, if you look at the original Constitution, what I call the Founders Constitution, you'll see the words slavery, slaveholder, slave, slaves don't appear in the text. And that was by design. James Madison used euphemisms instead of those words for slavery and slaveholder. And he did so because he didn't want to mar the text of the Constitution with those words. He hoped slavery would be ephemeral. And he purposely convinced the drafters of the Constitution to leave those words out. And that allowed some abolitionists, I think sometimes opportunistically or even cynically, to claim that the slavery wasn't even countenanced by the Constitution. And it forced defenders of slavery to to unpack that and explain how and why the Constitution certainly did, in several cases, the Three-Fifths Clause, the Fugitive Slave Clause, and the International Slave Trade Clause certainly impacts slavery and in many cases protect, defend, and perpetuate slavery. And Northern conservatives, given the epithet Doughface, usually Democratic, but a few Whigs, often supported white Southerners in their interpretations of the Constitution and in their protection of slavery. They often regarded this as their constitutional duty to do so. And so the Constitution really helps to is really part of these of the sectional conflict over slavery, the political conflict over slavery, and helps to it helps to shape how people sort themselves out in that conflict.
So on that note, how did the idea of a federal ban on the international slave trade, entwined with an ending to chattel slavery, persist into the antebellum period for both pro-slavery and anti-slavery proponents? And what were arguments perhaps offered for the opposite? Also, what was the significance and insignificance of slave trade revivalism as well as its symbolism in both the North and the South?
Well, there was, in 1787, 10 of the 13 states had actually banned the international slave trade themselves. And it was widely regarded as a barbarity, even by people who were perfectly happy to drive slaves in their own cotton fields or rice paddies. And so when the issue came before the Constitutional Convention, it seemed at first blush like that would be very straightforward matter to have the empower the federal government to ban something that had already been banned by 10 of the 13 states. And the three states that hadn't done so were South Carolina, North Carolina, and Georgia. But as it turned out, both anti-slavery founders and pro-slavery founders believed that the constant importation of slaves from either Africa itself or from other parts of the Americas that practiced slavery was absolutely necessary to the maintenance of the slave system. And that was actually true for the vast majority of the slave systems in the New World. But it was not true for the system in the United States. The United States, in the relatively early in the colonial era, I think around the 1740s, 1750s, established a more or less equal sex ratio between female and male slaves. And that allowed the slave population to be stabilized by a natural increase rather than importation. But the founders weren't aware of this. And so they believed that to ban the federal slave trade, or to have a federal ban on the slave trade, international slave trade, would be to end slavery in the United States, that eventually it would just cease to exist. All the slaves would, in essence, either would die off if they hadn't been liberated or freed themselves. And, of course, it didn't turn out that way, but that's part of what made that debate so fraught. And that's where we get the rather curious compromise that the International Slave Trade Clause has. What it does is it allows states to import slaves until 20 years after the ratification of the Constitution. If Congress chose to, after 20 years could pass some kind of regulation. Everyone knew Congress was going to pass a law that would in fact ban the federal slave trade. But in those 20 years until then, states were free to import new slaves. And South Carolina in particular imported the better part of 80,000 slaves from 1788 to January 1st, 1808. And to Thomas Jefferson was president in 1807. He, to his great credit, convinced that was the leading force. In fact, I argue that's his greatest anti-slavery contribution. Forced his party, which had majority in both the House and the Senate, to take up and pass the federal ban on the federal slave trade, or the international slave trade. In the 1850s, there started to be proponents of reviving the slave trade. And this was kind of a logical extension of the positive good defense of slavery. The premise was that if slavery was a benefit not just to the master, but also to the slave, him or herself, then the slave trade itself was a beneficial institution, a beneficial process, and should be encouraged. And the strange structure of the slave trade clause allowed both abolitionists and advocates and critics of the Constitution claiming to take credit. The pro-slavery, the abolitionists, the Garrisonians who criticized the Constitution as being pro-slavery, noted that the Constitution for 20 years allowed the barbarity of the Atlantic slave trade to commence, and that's absolutely true. But the proponents of the anti-slavery Constitution say, but after that, it absolutely forbids it. And a few years later, I think it's 1819, 1820, Congress passes a law making plying the slave trade, if you're an American, an act of piracy with a potential capital sentence. And so anyway, it's just one of those, it's many clauses of the Constitution were taken this way by advocates of slavery or opponents of slavery. And then, of course, the Garrisonians were their own little subset. But of you know, the actual text of the Constitution and the practice of the Constitution allowed there to be multiple, you know, sometimes quite disparate interpretations of the how the Constitution acted. And that gets back to your original question about how it's more or less neutral, but implemented in a pro-slavery fashion.
Thank you. How and why did the 1842 Prigg decision and the Compromise of 1850, including reauthorization of the Fugitive Slave Act, propel sectional divisions, slave power rhetoric, as well as Northern conservatism? In addition, what were the ensuing, quote, personal liberty laws and those rescue commemorations, and how did they galvanize debates over sustaining the rule of law?
Excellent questions. Prigg versus Pennsylvania was a case that concerned the rendition of a fugitive slave who had taken refuge in Pennsylvania. And a slaveholder hired a man named Prigg to go into Pennsylvania and take back a female slave and her children, who, although they've been born in the free state of Pennsylvania, due to state and law and federal policy were slaves by virtue of being born to a slave mother. This was the most important case when it concerned fugitive slaves. and at the time, the federal government had passed and Congress had passed and George Washington had signed the Fugitive Slave Act of 1793. And so that was the operative law. All these were efforts to implement the Fugitive Slave Clause in the Constitution, which gives it as a duty of states for comity, interstate comity, C-O-M-I-T-Y, to return to the state of origin of fugitive slaves, just as they would return to state of origin a fugitive from justice. And in Prigg versus Pennsylvania, Joseph Story, the leading exponent of the Constitution in the antebellum era, by far the most famous justice, also the author, Supreme Court justice, also the author of a slew of best-selling books about the Constitution, drafted the Prigg decision. And that upheld the right of the slaveholder to go into Pennsylvania, into a free state, despite the fact there were some personal liberty laws at that time passed trying to protect the rights of fugitive slaves. The Fugitive Slave Act of 1793 put the onus on the slaveholder to return his or her slave. The Fugitive Slave Act of 1850, which was passed as part of the Compromise of 1850, put the onus on the federal government to assist the slaveholder. And for that reason, then the federal fugitive slaveholders who alleged that they had a slave that had freed him or herself could actually get the help of federal marshals to detain and then try to return their slaves. And the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850 denied alleged fugitives all due process protections. They weren't permitted to give testimony. They weren't allowed to cross-examine their accuser. They weren't allowed to have a presumption of innocence. They weren't allowed to have the assistance of counsel. All rights, of course, enshrined in our Bill of Rights, part of the Constitution. And so after Prigg, and especially after the Compromise of 1850, most of the free states passed a slew of personal liberty laws, sometimes three or four apiece before the outbreak of the Civil War, conferring upon alleged fugitives these various due process protections, including the assistance of counsel, the assumption of innocence, the right to give testimony, the right to cross-examine their accusers, that sort of thing. And also some radical abolitionists took it in their into their hands to free alleged fugitives, and in fact, the most famous ones, of course, almost all of them, in fact, were actually proper fugitives. And this, of course, they used violence in the case of Anthony Burns, for example, in Boston in 1854. Even leading to the death of one of the guards. And this led to great recrimination among conservative Northerners and certainly white Southerners about the absence of law and order, the defiance of the Constitution, of constitutional obligations, and helped to erode the confidence that white Southerners had that the Constitution really was as protective as they thought it would be. Now, it turns out that the Constitution, as I think we'll discuss a little bit later in this interview, was an incredible protection to slavery. And, of course, the issue of fugitive slaves was a tiny, tiny issue for Southern slaveholders, except for those on the border South, you know, in Maryland and Kentucky. And it was not a big concern in the Deep South. It was very much a marginal issue, but it had great symbolic importance. The idea was that this was a constitutional obligation that the North had when it agreed to ratify the Constitution, to join the Union, and that the North clearly was not living up to this obligation. There was a brilliant book done in the 1960s that looked at all 300 or so cases of fugitive slaves that were were captured and considered under the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850's auspices, and it found that 93% were in fact returned to slavery, and so that these rescues and jury nullifications in some cases were incredibly rare and were very much went against the grain of the flow, but they were of course publicized by states' rights advocates and Southern extremists, and helped to form a real sense of grievance among white Southerners that the North was not living up to its constitutional obligations, that it was defying the Constitution, that if they couldn't trust them on this, what else were they going to do to try to undermine slavery? And all this compounds with the South's feeling of being a besieged, white Southerners, slaveholders' feeling of being a besieged minority in the system set up by the Constitution, which I think we'll speak about quite soon.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and
asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
How and why did state parity in the Senate help Southerners prevent the North from gaining a majority in the Senate and, along with the three-fifths compromise, keep the South competitive in presidential elections? Also, how were pro-slavery and conservative Northerners' fears of Western free soil linked to an anti-slavery amendment? And why did much debate center over Delaware, Washington, D.C., and that gag rule?
As I say, parity in the Senate was far more important than the three-fifths clause in protecting the Southern minority from, quote, the tyranny of the Northern majority, unquote. White Southerners in the 1780s, but certainly in the 1830s, 40s, and 50s, when the sectional conflict over slavery became incredibly hot and intense and vitriolic, worried about Northern tyranny, in other words, about the North using its numerical majority to use our democratic system, the constitutional system, to impose regulations on slavery and possibly ultimately anti-slavery or our abolition amendments. For example, efforts to curb the domestic slave trade, efforts to impose a gradual emancipation program on slaves, efforts to just immediately abolish slavery. There were a whole host of fears. And so white Southerners were really worried about the North using its numerical advantage in the House to pass legislation, anti-slavery or abolitionist legislation. They were worried about the North using its majority in the Electoral College to elect anti-slavery presidents. And they came to rely on parity in the Senate as its their most effective bulwark against this, quote, tyranny of the Northern majority, unquote. Parity in the Senate, quite simply, was the idea of maintaining the number of free states to be equal to the number of slave states. In that way, the South could ensure that the North would never have, no matter how large the North's majority in the House might be, no matter how anti-slavery a president might be, the South could ensure that anti-slavery legislation would never make it to the president's desk. Anti-slavery legislation would die in the Senate. And the process of parity in the Senate, which I think is worthy of its own in-depth study, frankly, it begins at least as early the 1790s. And you'll see, if you look at the dates of admission, that states are carefully balanced and calibrated. Usually it's a free state that's admitted first and then a counterbalancing slave state, but that's not always the case. And parity in the Senate ensured then, and this process goes all the way up to 1850, and it's only with the admission of California as a free state in 1850 that upsets parity in the Senate. White Southerners had expected, and in fact most Americans had expected, California to be divided into two states, Northern California a free state, Southern California a slave state. And Californians, not for the last time, defied and surprised national expectations by coming in as one massive free state. And this, as it turned out, ended parity in the Senate. Now, that wasn't, of course, immediately known, and white Southerners cast about trying to restore parity in the Senate. They did so in several ways. One, they tried to cut California in half. They tried to make carve out a part of South California that could be a slave state. They also tried to make Utah and New Mexico into slave states through popular sovereignty, and of course that failed. They also engineered the repeal of the Missouri Compromise, which was simply a piece of legislation passed by Congress and signed into law by President James Monroe. And they tried then, and that of course allowed the possibility of slavery in the remnants of the Louisiana Purchase, and they tried to make famously make Kansas into a slave state, which led to Bleeding Kansas in the 1850s. And all these efforts failed. But that was why the South was so concerned about the westward expansion of slavery. I argue that that's far more important than soil erosion and leaching of nutrients in the eastern seaboard southern states. That far more important. The westward expansion of slavery turned out to be the immediate most pressing political issue that causes the Civil War. The Democratic Party splits over the westward expansion of slavery. The Republican Party forms over the westward expansion of slavery. Of course, the Republican Party opposes the admission of new slave states. The Democratic Party divides into a part of the Democratic Party that wants, in 1860, that wants a federal slave code. In other words, all slavery to be in all the Western territories. The Northern Democrats, led by Stephen A. Douglas in the election of 1860, favor national, or I should say popular sovereignty. In other words, allowing the residents of the territories themselves to decide whether they're slave states or not. And this issue, this incredibly important issue, the westward expansion of slavery, has its import because of parity in the Senate. Everyone realized that parity in the Senate was this huge bulwark protecting slavery. Abolitionists who hoped to pass an anti-slavery amendment realized that they had an incredibly steep hill to climb because they had to get two-thirds of each House of Congress to approve an anti-slavery amendment, and then they had to get three-quarters of the states. And this would prove to be an incredibly high bar. In fact, it was only surmounted because of the Civil War and the disruption of national politics. And I argue that the parity in the Senate was such an incredible protection for white Southerners' practice of slavery that I note that even today in our union of 50 states, that if all 15 slave states had refused to assent to the 13th Amendment, it would not have passed even today. We would need to have 60 states and the other 45 free and supporting it. And so white Southerners, in their efforts to secede, from their point of view, tragically miscalculate about, they don't realize just what an effective bulwark parity in the Senate and the incredible difficulty we have in amending our Constitution were for the protection of slavery. And I should note that our Constitution is among, if not the most difficult to amend in the world, or perhaps the most difficult to amend in the world. And so the parity in the Senate then was an incredible protection to white Southerners. Added to this was and of course, that's an implementation of the Constitution, right? That parity in the Senate is not required by the Constitution. Was also another part of this was the two-party system. The two-party system, which was, imposed on, was highly likely to be brought about because of our first past the post or winner-take-all system of politics in single member electoral districts. All those things strongly tend towards, according to Derringer's law, towards a strong two-party system. What that meant was that both the first political party system between the Democratic Republicans and the Federalists, and then later the second one between the Whigs and the Democrats, the national parties tried to evade the issue of slavery because they wanted to appeal to voters in the North and the South, non-slaveholding voters and slaveholding voters. And for that reason, then, they tended to balance their presidential tickets. They frequently had a slaveholder and a non-slaveholder, a northerner and a southerner, on the ticket, and they would often alternate. If a slaveholder was at the top of the ticket in year four, then the slaveholder would be a slaveholder would be vice president, and a non-slaveholder would be the presidential candidate in year eight, if you like, the next presidential cycle. And doughfaces, Northern Democrats, usually Democrats, occasionally Whigs, so-called Northern men with Southern principles, served a valuable role in this system of serving as the running mates to white Southerners, and in some cases, playing a key role as president in passing crucial legislation. For example, the repeal of the Missouri Compromise by the Kansas-Nebraska Act in 1854 by Pierce, Franklin Pierce. So the combination of the two-party practice, parity in the Senate, and the use of dough faces were all pro-slavery practice that went beyond the more or less neutral Constitution. I think it was more pro-slavery than anti-slavery, but it certainly had some anti-slavery in the text and structure of the Constitution, but its implementation was far more pro-slavery than anti-slavery.
Between 1858 and 1860.
I should note that the focus on the westward expansion of slavery also made white Southern slaveholders concerned about, the necessary for parity in the Senate made white Southern slaveholders really worried about losing some of their states. There are a couple of marginal slave states, Delaware first and foremost among them, who are in danger of becoming free states. Delaware had a tiny slave population. It's less than 2,000 in 1850. It's less than 1,200. In 1860, it was widely expected by Northerners and Southerners to flip from a free state to a slave state, and that made white Southerners all the more anxious about trying to restore parity in the Senate in the 1850s. As it turned out, Delaware would tenaciously hang on to slavery until the 13th Amendment, despite blandishments by the Lincoln administration during the Civil War of compensated emancipation. But this did focus, this helps to explain why what the westward expansion of slavery was so important. It helps to explain why white Southern slaveholders in the Deep South were worried about the status of slavery in Missouri, in Kentucky, in Maryland, and in Delaware. They were quite worried about the so-called slave drain, where they would lose these marginal slave states, these border slave states. And they would go to the free state column and make it that much easier for Northern legislators to possibly pass an anti-slavery amendment.
Between 1858 and 1860, how did a sectional party system enervate leadership roles and disrupt the functioning of the three federal branches? While the Northern majority overcame divisions and began to vote as a bloc, a la the Southern minority. Also, why did these doughfaces and Southerners conceive of Lincoln's 1860 election as unconstitutional?
The constitutional system really started to feel strain under the sectional, with the rise of a sectional party, with the rise of the the Liberty Party, then the Free Soil Party, and most importantly, the Liberty Party in 1840 and 44, the Free Soil Party in 1848 and 1852, and most especially by the Republican Party, which of course is the lineal of forebear of today's Republican Party. The Republican Party began as a response to the Kansas-Nebraska Act, which repealed the Missouri Compromise, and these quote anti-Nebraska unquote, many of them Whigs, some of them Democrats, were angered by the end of this sectional compromise, which, although it was merely a piece of legislation, had this kind of halo, this aura of being actually as essentially part of the Constitution itself. And they formed this so-called sectional party, a party that made the Republican Party that made no effort to win white Southern votes, that was predicated on just turning out abolitionists and free soilers, people who opposed slavery and people who opposed the westward expansion of slavery. And the Republican Party in the presidential election of 1856 came within just two states, Pennsylvania and either Illinois or Indiana, of actually winning the presidential election. An incredibly auspicious beginning for the Republican Party. And it just served notice that this long-standing system of national parties balancing their tickets with Northern and Southern running mates, of dough faces helping out Southern Southerners in the House and the Senate in passing legislation that helped slavery or protected slavery or defended slavery. This whole system was in jeopardy. And our whole system frankly, even now, is dependent on a whole host of people working well together. A modern example would be there are a lot of things in the Senate that can only proceed or can proceed quickly if they have unanimous consent. And if they don't have unanimous consent, that can cause the whole thing to be a very tedious, long process, right? They have to read every bill, for example, every word of every bill. And a very similar crisis, paralysis, innervation took place in the late 1850s. Probably the most famous example of this was the inability to select a speaker for the House of Representatives. If a speaker could not be elected, then the president could not give his address to the joint session of Congress, or the tradition that we now have in the State of the Union address. And it meant that no bills could be passed. The whole government was in effect paralyzed. And there were multiple crises in the late 1850s about electing a speaker of the House. And this was showed very clearly the breakdown in the two-party system, the breakdown in the system of having two national parties with dough faces helping to cobble together effectively a pro-slavery governing majority. And a similar crisis was with these presidents, and the last two presidents before the Civil War were Northern dough faces, Franklin Pierce from New Hampshire, and James Buchanan, who is often listed as perhaps as one of the very worst presidents, a dough face from Pennsylvania, and they had they were people who were selected largely because of being genially pro-Southern and pro-slavery. The whole system started to break down with very little effective leadership from the presidents, Congress being, paralyzed. And when it did finally organize, sputtering, having members, especially in the House, but also in the Senate, being armed, having nasty confrontations, including fist fights and threats of personal violence with firearms, and even the Supreme Court, which had a long time held itself up as being above the fray, the political and sectional fray, had weakened its political standing and its regard nationwide by its notorious Dred Scott decision in 1857, where it very bluntly said that it was unconstitutional for the Congress to pass laws that that prohibited the slaves from being taken into the Western territories. A pretty shocking bit of actually putting their thumb on the political scale. And of course, along the way, Chief Justice Taney, who wrote the spelled Taney, but pronounced Taney, put his thumb on the scale and clearly said that people of African descent were not intended by the founders to be citizens, and hence were not, even though there were many, many citizens, black citizens of the United States. They'd voted, they'd been issued passports, they'd fought in wars, they did all sorts of things that showed that they were citizens. And so, by that time then, there were real concerns all across the American political spectrum about our constitutional form of government, about how it was acting under the incredible strains of the sectional tensions over the political issue of slavery. Lincoln's election, or the presidential election of 1860, was perhaps the coup de grace, the final blow. As I said before, the Republicans ran Abraham Lincoln on a free soil platform, a platform that was that would not let slavery to expand. In other words, would keep the South from restoring parity in the Senate. The Northern Democratic Party, the Democratic Party, if it had stayed united, would have certainly prevailed. Instead, divided over the westward expansion of slavery. John Breckinridge ran as a Southern Democrat on a slavery in all the territories. Stephen A. Douglas ran as a unpopular sovereignty, which in other words allow the voters of the territories to decide. Lincoln, of course, and there's a fourth party, the Constitutional Union Party, which takes no stance on the great issues of the day, but just tries to cash in on a reverence for the Constitution. Lincoln wins. He wins a crushing electoral victory, a great electoral victory, but only less than 40% of the popular vote. And many Southerners and even some Northern doughfaces regard his election as unfair or unconstitutional or against the spirit of the Constitution, technically legal or constitutional, but really not a disgraceful election. They regarded it as inherently unfair for a presidential candidate to be a president to be elected without any electoral votes from the South. And in fact, the Republicans weren't even on the lists in a majority of the slave states. You couldn't even vote for Lincoln if you wanted to in the Deep South. And he received, you know, several, you know, tens of thousands of votes from some of the upper South states, like Virginia, Maryland. But he was clearly a president that did not receive a majority of the popular vote, did not receive he received a plurality of the popular vote, and he was a president who received no electoral votes from the South, and who was regarded as an enemy of the South, and despite the fact that Lincoln had a rather moderate policy on slavery, he was not an abolitionist. He was a person who regarded slavery personally as a morally evil, and he foresaw the end of slavery due to its internal contradictions. He had no anti-slavery platform. He pledged to enforce the laws as they were, including the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850, and he certainly his election, nonetheless, his election was perceived by many white Southerners as the first of a series of increasingly anti-slavery Northern tyrants. One Southerner, Edwin Ruffin, calls it an abolitionist dynasty. And so it's in response to this so-called unconstitutional election of Lincoln that white Southerners really start talking about secession.
Please briefly trace debates over and opinions on the federal constitution as a compact between the states and the constitution as the supreme law of the land under the supremacy clause. In your brief assessment, please address how and why most antebellum Americans believe that the federal constitution was established by both the people and the states, and how this common belief shifted to debates over the constitutional right to secede in both the North and the South.
That's a great question. Antebellum Americans had what we might consider mixed or incoherent even views about the fundamental nature of the Constitution. There were two main views of it, and we even have this to a certain extent even today. One is a compact of the states, in other words, an agreement between the states. Under this notion, and this was the notion favored by states' rights advocates, in the South, and some of them in the North, of course, the states were sovereigns, and they ceded some part of their sovereignty to the federal government for limited, narrow, expressed ends that were outlined in the Constitution. For example, the common defense, imposing tariffs, that sort of thing, having common weights and measures. But the rest of their sovereignty they retained. And since it was a compact, which is a kind of a fancy word for an agreement, if the federal government overstepped its proper domains, if it started intruding upon or usurping powers that were properly reserved to the states could in fact leave the Constitution, could secede, or a step before that, they could nullify an unconstitutional law. In other words, make that law null and void within the confines, within the borders of that state. The other main school of thought was that the Constitution set up a permanent frame of government or a charter of government. And the idea of that was that the states, in essence, made themselves, or the people of the states, made those states an inferior political subset. That the states, when they joined the Union, subsumed their sovereignty into national sovereignty, and they had only limited powers. And that this was a permanent union. Once you joined, you couldn't leave. And that the states weren't sovereign, but we, the people, as the preamble set forth. And I have to say that the Constitution itself, the Founders' Constitution, has since kind of mixed messages about this. There are certainly arguments to be made on both sides. For example, the preamble clearly says we, the people, are sovereign, and we, the people, elect our representatives to the House. And of course, those representatives are we elect people to the Electoral College. We elect delegates in some cases, originally at least, indirectly, and by the approach of the Civil War, directly delegates to the electors to the Electoral College. And of course, people have rights that individual people have rights that were spelled out in the Bill of Rights. And so that might make us think it's quite clear that the Constitution really is a charter or a permanent frame of government. But there's actually quite a bit in the Founders' Constitution that undercuts that, that suggests it's a compact of the states. Article 7 lays out the ratification clause, and that clearly gives states the power to ratify the Constitution. The Constitution wouldn't come into power, in other words, until the states, not the people, but the states said it did. It made the states, in effect, so many sovereigns. Also, the states, in Article 1 and 2, have the states elect the senators. The senators, until the 17th Amendment in the early 20th century, the senators actually represented the states, not the people in those states. And, of course, that part of the Electoral College was, in essence, representing the states. And most states by the 1850s actually had direct election of the senators, but for much of the constitutional history, many states had indirect election of senators. In other words, or electors, I should say, electors were appointed. And of course, before the incorporation of the Bill of Rights, the individual states could and did limit the liberties that the people enjoyed in the Bill of Rights. And they, of course, did that until selective incorporation began in the mid-20th century. And lastly, the states can change the Constitution itself through the Amendment Clause in Article 5. And so there were advocates of a compact, had quite a bit of evidence to support this interpretation, and advocates of a charter or permanent frame of government had quite a bit of evidence to support their interpretation. And of course, part of this seeming inconsistency is the fact that the Constitution was not written by one person or a small group of people. It was written by a large group of people who made a series of political compromises and who didn't necessarily agree on the fundamental nature of the Constitution. And it goes even beyond that. The Guarantee Clause gives the federal government the power to intervene in the kind of counterbalancing. The Amendment Clause gives the states the power, or the federal government, the power to intervene in a state to, quote, ensure a Republican form of government. And then lastly, the 10th Amendment states that the people and the states have powers that were not expressly delegated to the federal government. And those remain. And of course, that seems to support both we the people being sovereign and the states being sovereign. And so the Constitution had lots of had arguments on both sides, and ordinary Americans did not see them as opposites, the compact and the charter. In fact, I unearthed many letters written by Northerners and Southerners, pro-slavery, anti-slavery, doughfaces, so forth and so on, where they basically say the Constitution is both a compact and a charter. and this helps to undergird the idea of whether there's a constitutional right to secede. Some white Southerners, advocates of states' rights advocates of the compact theory, believed, of course, secession was all along an implicit right, one of those powers that were that weren't named but were retained by the states. They thought it was preposterous that there was an idea that you could join the union but could never leave. I like to joke in my classes that that sounds kind of like the mob, right? You can join the mob, but you can you can't leave the mob. And advocates of the permanent frame of government said it was exactly that. The states had subsumed their sovereignty into the federal government. They could not leave. It was an absolute impossibility. And I found cases of even anti-slavery Northerners admitting there was a Southern right to secede. Now, many of them would quibble and say, rather than being a constitutional right, it was in fact a natural, a right of natural law. In other words, if they were an oppressed person, they could go. But that meant, of course, it was extra constitutional rather than constitutional. But this was an issue that was widely debated and discussed at this time. And once the Civil War began, though, opinions in the North hardened and even most dough faces regarded secession as unconstitutional, as a real threat to the rule of law, as a blow to the model republic, right? Many of them thought there was nothing, the Civil War had at stake the very future of constitutional government, democratic constitutional government, not just in the United States, but in the world. They believed the United States was the model republic, and that if constitutional government, democratic constitutional government failed in the United States, it would fail. You know, our great example would not be followed by other nations. It would all go horribly wrong. And of course, white Southerners, once the war began, even those who had, most of those anyway, even those who had qualms about the niceties of secession, was it constitutional right? Was it a resort of natural law? Was it warranted? Was this the right response? Most of those white Southerners closed ranks and supported secession as being the proper remedy, regardless of whether it was a constitutional right or a resort of natural law.
How and why was the secession crisis a stalemate over federal efforts to maintain union as attempts to compromise versus attempts at coercion? Further, what were examples of Northern and Southern demands in such proposals, and how did the lame duck period aggravate the crisis?
The secession crisis was a stalemate. The Constitution was silent, of course, about secession. It didn't say states could secede. It didn't say states could not secede. It was also silent, of course, about what to do if states did secede. And so President James Buchanan often, I have to say, vilified or demonized, was in an incredibly difficult position. He was facing a literally unprecedented crisis, and it was not clear what to do. One option, of course, was coercion. He could, at least in theory, claim this was a clear violation of the Constitution, secession, and have, as commander-in-chief, lead the U.S. Armed Forces into the South and enforce the Constitution, the rule of law in those states. That would be, of course, a really momentous step. And Buchanan was quite reluctant to do that, A, because he was a doughface. B, he wasn't sure it would, of course, work. And C, he was worried about, as he becomes a lame duck president. The election, of course, takes place in November. Then there's this four-month period until Lincoln takes over, when he's merely president-elect. And Buchanan's quite... does not want to tie the hands of his successor. He does not want to take such a strong action that it cannot be undone. He doesn't think that's fair. And so it's kind of a stalemate. Since coercion seems to be untenable, he pins his hopes on compromise. Now, of course, the United States Congress had passed a series of compromise bills, laws about slavery, the Missouri Compromise of 1819, 2021, the Compromise of 1833, the Compromise of 1850, and those had, you know, kind of patched over the sectional conflict over slavery. But Congress, of course, was not as highly functioning as it was in 1819, in the 1820s and the 1830s, or certainly in 1850. They have the rise of the Republicans. It's compounded by the fact that the president's a lame duck, that a so-called sectional president was poised to take over. It was also aggravated by the fact that Congress would go out of session just as the new president would take over. We've solved many of these some of these problems about the lame duck period for both Congress and the president today with several amendments and changes in practice. But the U.S. system back then just was not prepared to handle a crisis like this. And it would take really effective leadership by a president to cobble together some kind of compromise. And of course, the other problem was the compromises all related to the westward expansion of slavery and the protection of slavery. And they're quite simply, it was a real stretch to get the Compromise of 1850, 10, 11 years earlier. In fact, many historians regard this as an armistice because there was very little compromising done. Just a small group of swing voters helped make the difficult votes possible for both the pro-North provisions and the pro-Southern provisions. And so all these efforts undercut the ability for compromise. There was not strong presidential leadership. The president was a lame duck. The parties were divided. They could not agree. The South basically asked for provisions that would protect slavery from a constitutional amendment. Even though, frankly, we now know, I argue very clearly, I think that those weren't necessary. And the North, of course, could not agree to grant it. And so neither coercion nor compromise was able to resolve the secession crisis. The various proposals to resolve the sectional crisis, the so-called Crittenden Compromise, the Washington Peace Plan, these all had elements of compensation for slaveholders whose fugitives were not properly rendered to them under the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850, protections against, additional Southern states, slave states, so that they could restore parity in the Senate, protections against anti-slavery legislation, all those sorts of things. And those were just the sorts of things that certainly Republicans, but even some Democrats, weren't prepared to grant. And so at the very end, I argue that the Constitution was unable to resolve the political dispute over slavery. The South was a political minority. It wanted to protect its economic, social institution of slavery. And over time, the North became increasingly less willing to agree to abide by slavery. And the Constitution was unable, for a variety of reasons, to resolve this dispute. The two-party system was not nimble enough. The meetings of Congress and the assumption of power by the new president were not seamless enough. The whole structure of the federal government was unable, when push came to shove, to resolve this issue. And that's ultimately why we have the Civil War. That's why I argue the Constitution, the Constitution's inability to resolve the political dispute over slavery causes this Civil War. And the Civil War settles these matters to a great extent. Not many people today argue the Constitution is a compact of the states. Not many people argue, at least not many political leaders and commentators argue that secession is a proper remedy for aggrieved minorities, political minorities in states. The Constitution finally has an anti-slavery amendment that begins the process of fundamentally changing the founder's Constitution. Quickly on its heels, we'll see the 14th and the 15th Amendments fundamentally reshaping the relationship between the federal government and the states, and the federal government's interest in protecting certain groups of people from discrimination that had for decades been certainly perfectly constitutional and business as usual. And it reflects, I think, in the end, the triumph of the jurisprudence of the living Constitution, of the American people changing the Constitution to bring it into line with their changing beliefs and preferences and practices. I think that's key to our Constitution, which is, of course, the longest standing and serving Constitution, to having such a long span. You know, France has had five different constitutions in the span of our one Constitution. And part of the trick to allowing our Constitution to grow and expand with the Constitution is this de facto adoption of this living Constitution jurisprudence. It's allowed the United States to grow from a small settler community of about 3 or 4 million on the Eastern Seaboard to becoming a superpower that spans the entire continent of North America from the Atlantic to the Pacific, has over 300 million people. Incredibly diverse population, ethnically, racially, religiously, and so forth and so on. And it's, I think, of course, how we will have to proceed in this American experiment in constitutional democratic self-government.
Well, thank you for being on the show today, Professor Conlin. On behalf of the New Books Network, this is Ryan Tripp. The book is The Constitutional Origins of the American Civil War, out earlier this year by Cambridge University Press. Please tune in next time.